Women have been playing football for more than 150 years, and it's always been political. Some have been celebrated, but others have been ridiculed, criticized, and forgotten. This is the Forgotten 11, the hidden history of women's football.
I'm not going to the White House. No.
You know, there was a lot of critics talking about us, but we're back, so it's not been that long.
Give me the effing ball.
Playing like a girl means you're a badass.
Welcome to the Forgotten 11. I'm Chris. Today's show is not about football. It's not even about sports. But it is related. You've heard about the U.S. team calling for equal pay. Matilda's calling for equal prize money. I've talked about women getting the vote in the 20th century. I've mentioned that even when women did get the vote, they weren't equal. On Friday, September 18th, 2020, we lost someone. Almost single-handedly, Ruth Bader Ginsburg changed how the world treats women under the law. Not just here in the United States. Each part of her story of oppression and empowerment could be a lifetime achievement. But the fact that she did all of it, over and over, reaching too far and accomplishing her dreams and goals is inspiring. But more than that, she did all of it, not for herself, but for us. Joan Ruth Bader was born in Brooklyn, New York, in 1933, to Nathan and Celia Bader. She preferred to be called Ruth. Celia Bader was only ever able to attend high school, and she wanted her daughter to get a good education. Maybe Ruth could become a high school teacher. Celia died the day before Ruth graduated high school. Ruth Bader attended Cornell University and graduated as the top woman in her class in 1954. She married Martin Ginsburg a month after graduation, and they moved to Oklahoma, where Martin did military service, and Ruth worked for the Social Security Administration. She was soon demoted because she was pregnant. She was lucky not to be fired. This, by the way, was common until the 1970s in the United States. Ruth had her baby in 1955 and then decided to do something unusual. She decided to go to Harvard Law School. Her husband also attended. Ginsburg was one of just 9 women in a class of 500. The dean of Harvard Law would regularly invite those 9 women to dinner at his home and would ask them, "Why are you at Harvard Law School, taking the place of a man?" Seriously. They didn't want women there. In 1958, Ruth's husband, Martin, got cancer. At the time, treatment was pretty brutal. Martin got very sick. Ruth Bader Ginsburg helped care for him through his treatment. Her days were something like this. She attended her law classes and her husband's classes to take notes. She took care of her 3-year-old daughter, and she helped Martin with his homework. She did the housekeeping. She would finish all of that around 2 a.m. And then she would start on her own homework. She also wrote for the Harvard Law Review. In 1959, Martin had graduated and got a job in New York City, so Ruth transferred to Columbia Law and wrote for their law review. She graduated in 1959. And now she faced a problem. In 1960, no law firm in New York would hire a woman. No law firm would hire a mother. And most law firms would not hire a Jew. And she was all of those things. After one of her professors threatened a federal judge, she became a clerk for the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York. She clerked for 2 years, while also still raising her child. Oh, and she was also an associate director of the Columbia Law School Project on International Procedure, where she learned Swedish so she could co-author a book in Swedish about Swedish law. She also traveled to Sweden to study the Swedish laws. In 1963, Ruth Bader Ginsburg became a professor of law at Rutgers University, one of just 20 female law professors in the entire country. She was told by the university that she would be paid less than the male professors because her husband had a good job. In 1970, she co-founded the Women's Rights Law Reporter. It was the first law review dedicated to women's rights in the United States. In 1972, she went to teach at Columbia Law School. She also co-founded the Women's Rights Project at the American Civil Liberties Union. And this Women's Rights Project is where Ruth Bader Ginsburg first becomes a rock star. Ruth Bader Ginsburg took 6 cases to the Supreme Court to argue for gender equality, but they were not what you would expect. The first, a man in Missouri, was convicted of a crime, but Ginsburg said he did not get a trial by a jury of his peers. What do you mean? There were tall guys on the jury. See, in Missouri, women could serve on a jury, but they didn't have to serve. It was called a woman's privilege. Here's Ruth.
First, the right central in this case, the right secured by the Sixth Amendment, is the criminal defendant's, here Billy Doran's, right to a fair chance for a jury genuinely representative of the community's complexion. And second, the vaunted woman's privilege, viewed against history's backdrop, simply reflects and perpetuates a certain way of thinking about women. Women traditionally were deemed lesser citizens.
That wouldn't concern Mr. Doran, would it?
Mr. Doran has a right to a jury drawn from a panel reasonably representative of the community.
The sex criterion stigmatizes when, as in Hoyt against Florida, 368 U.S., it assumes that all women are preoccupied with home and children and therefore should be spared the basic civic responsibility of serving on a jury. These distinctions have a common effect. They help keep woman in her place, a place inferior to that occupied by men in our society.
To sum up her argument, she argued that Billy Doran could not have gotten a fair trial because there was no woman on the jury. A man had been denied justice exactly because there were no women sitting in judgment. She didn't take up the case of a woman who, say, had been denied jury service, which would have run into all the sexism and nonsense of the weaker sex. She argued that a man was injured because of sexism. It was genius. Ginsburg's next case was equally genius. Widow's insurance, or pensions, are, at the core, kind of sexist. If a husband dies at work, his wife, now widow, gets all or some of his retirement funds. The idea here is that the man makes all the money, so a woman who lost her husband would be instantly poor. But it also ignores the fact that for a very long time, women weren't allowed to work, or when they did work, they weren't paid as well as men. Remember, Ginsburg was paid less at Rutgers because her husband had a good job. So in the U.S., we have a national system called Social Security. When you retire, you can collect your benefits and those of your husband. Leon Goldfarb and his wife both worked all their lives, but she died. Leon wanted to collect his benefits and those of his wife. He was denied because he wasn't a wife. Here's Ruth again.
Pursuant to the Federal Insurance Contributions Act, payments into Social Security's Old Age and Survivors Insurance Program are exacted from gainfully employed men and women without regard to the sex of the contributor, whether the wage earner is a man or a woman. Equal earnings require equal contributions. In contrast to the gender-neutral contribution system, the program draws a sharp line between the sexes on the payout side. Benefits to a spouse available under a male wage earner's account are not equally available under a female wage earner's account.
The Supreme Court in the 1970s is 9 men. Once again, she is arguing that men are being injured or denied benefits because of the unequal treatment of women. Ginsburg's next case involved taxes. In Florida, widows got a property tax break. Ginsburg argued that men should also get that tax break if they lose their spouse, that taxes should be collected on the basis of income and assets and not on the basis of gender or race or any other physical characteristic.
An income test is readily available to a legislature that wishes to distinguish on the basis of need. An immutable birth characteristic should be irrelevant for general law purposes.
Air Force Lieutenant Sharon Frontiero and her husband Joseph had a problem. If a man joins the military, his wife and kids become military dependents, so the wife and kids can shop at the cheaper military stores. They can see the military doctors and get an allowance or an income and live in military housing. Part of the reason for this is that many bases are far from the nearest towns. And some of the U.S. bases are in other countries like Japan, Italy, and Germany. When Lieutenant Frontiero applied for these benefits for her husband, she was denied. She made 3 times what he did and felt he deserved those benefits.
What is known is that by employing the sex criterion, identically situated persons are treated differently. The married serviceman gets benefits for himself, as well as his spouse, regardless of her income. The married servicewoman is denied medical care for her spouse and quarters allowance for herself as well as her spouse, even if, as in this case, she supplies over 2/3 the support of the marital unit. For these reasons, Amicus believes that the sex-related means employed by Congress fails to meet the rationality standard. It does not have a fair and substantial relationship to the legislative objective, so that all similarly circumstanced persons shall be treated alike. Nonetheless, Amicus urges the court to recognize in this case what it has in others, that it writes not only for this case and this day alone, but for this type of case.
So with just 6 cases, Ginsburg reformed jury selection, pension payments, the tax system, and military dependents. She ensured that huge institutions of government would now treat men and women equally under the law. And then she was done arguing in front of the Supreme Court. In 1980, President Jimmy Carter appointed her to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. This is the second highest court in the United States. In her time on this court, she was considered cautious and deliberate. In 1993, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was appointed to the Supreme Court of the United States by Bill Clinton. She served on the Supreme Court for 27 years, recently holding court from her hospital bed. Her opinions and dissents reflect her belief that all persons should be equal before the law. She often disagreed with her colleagues and had this to say about it.
Dissents speak to a future age. It's not simply to say my colleagues are wrong and I would do it this way. The greatest dissents do become court opinions, and gradually, over time, their views become the dominant view. So that's the dissenter's hope. They aren't writing not for today, but for tomorrow.
Before she died, on Thursday, she delivered her last words to the public. My most fervent wish is that I not be replaced until a new president is installed. Ruth Bader Ginsburg spent her life fighting for the rights of women and all people. She very much believed that an injustice to one person was an injustice to all people, that we are all equal. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg will be the first woman to lay in state in the U.S. Capitol. Rest in peace and solidarity, Justice Ginsburg.
Sex, like race, is a visible, immutable characteristic bearing no necessary relationship to ability. Sex, like race, has been made the basis for unjustified, or at least unproved, assumptions concerning an individual's potential to perform or to contribute to society.